Well, it's my pleasure to be speaking about transcendentalism today. Sally asked me to address the issue of transcendentalism. What is it? It's easier described than defined. What I have to say this morning comes from my latest book, published just a few months ago, called Transcendentalism, Yesterday and Today. Acclaimed Emerson scholar David Robinson, himself a Unitarian Universalist, once said the following: "Like a pauper who searches for the next meal, never knowing of the relatives whose will would make him rich, American Unitarians lament their vague religious identity, standing upon the richest spiritual legacy of any American denomination. Possessed of a deep and sustaining history of spiritual achievement and philosophical speculation, religious liberals have been, ironically, dispossessed of that heritage." He observed that Unitarian Universalists suffer from a disturbing malaise. On the one hand, we seem troubled by a vague sense of our religious identity and our marginal place among the established American faiths. On the other hand, he noted that Unitarian Universalists, like many other Americans, are searching for a greater sense of spirituality in their lives and churches. Both of these conditions are linked in Robinson's mind with a collective amnesia or ignorance concerning our own very rich and compelling spiritual heritage. For all of its notable contributions to American literature, transcendentalism was at heart a religious movement. In particular, it was a generational revolt within the ranks of Unitarianism during the 1830s and 40s, not unlike the countercultural rebellion of the 1960s. The Unitarians had succeeded in breaking away from the Calvinist churches during the early decades of the 19th century. They did so largely by applying reason to religious matters and insisting that, contrary to the Calvinist doctrine of predestination, human beings were able to contribute to their own salvation by leading moral lives. But the Unitarians were only willing to go so far. They still considered themselves Christians and held onto the validity of Jesus' miracles as evidence of the truth of their faith. The younger generation of Unitarians did not feel similarly constrained. They were inclined to pursue these assumptions to their logical conclusions. Though never an organized movement, they looked to the unofficial leadership of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson had attracted notice among his younger colleagues and followers with the publication of his first book, Nature, in 1836. The book was largely a reflection on the spiritual influences of nature. In it, Emerson introduced several themes that were central to the transcendentalist movement that followed. The first of these was the bold assertion that faith could only be had at first hand, as a direct result of experience. It was not a matter of tradition that could be passed down. Christianity was based on revelation, and the church insisted that revelation was long since sealed. "Not so," argued Emerson. "The foregoing generations beheld God and nature face to face, we through their eyes. Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe? Why should we not have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition, and a religion by revelation to us and not a history of theirs?" As if to throw down a gauntlet, he declared, "Let us demand our own works and laws and worship." Spiritual insight was the key. Religion was not a matter of scriptures, creeds, and church teachings. For Emerson and the transcendentalists, it was essentially intuitive, based on a direct, almost mystical experience of the natural world. In the presence of nature, we are conscious of a universal soul within or behind our individual life. by virtue of the fact that all of creation is informed and animated by this universal soul, all beings are related to one another. All are part and parcel of the whole and cannot be understood apart from it. As Emerson observed, a leaf, a drop, a crystal, a moment of time is related to the whole and partakes of the perfection of the whole. Each particle is a microcosm and faithfully renders the likeness of the world. And because of this, all of nature ministers and preaches to us. The spirit, which thus scents the air, grows in the grain and impregnates the waters of the world, he wrote, is caught by us and sinks into our soul. As you might imagine, some of his readers were elated at this message. Others were quite aghast. Emerson's critics, mainly the Orthodox Unitarians, termed it pantheism, paganism, mysticism, atheism even. For his supporters, it was a breath of fresh air and the beginning of a theological revolution that would change the nature of Unitarianism and indeed the course of religion in America. Although Nature had been published anonymously, his public soon found him out. Emerson was not alone in espousing these views. He was at the center of a circle of several dozen Boston area men and women, virtually all of whom were Unitarians and mostly ministers at that. The nucleus of the group were members of an informal club that included, besides Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Theodore Parker, Bronson Alcott, Henry David Thoreau, Elizabeth Peabody, James Freeman Clark, George Ripley, and numerous others. We don't recognize all these names today, but each of these people had influential careers variously as writers, ministers, educators, and social reformers. Margaret Fuller wrote the first feminist manifesto in America, Woman in the 19th Century. Henry David Thoreau was a naturalist and author of Walden, one of the most significant books published in this country. George Ripley and his wife, Sophia, established Brook Farm, a socialist cooperative community. Bronson Alcott and Elizabeth Peabody introduced notable reforms in childhood education. Theodore Parker preached to an audience of thousands each week in Boston. James Freeman Clark, who went on to become a president of the American Unitarian Association, made important changes in church polity and worship. And virtually all of them were actively involved in the abolitionist movement. Central importance was the notion of self-culture. While the term might seem a bit old-fashioned to us today, it held that the goal of the religious life was the culture or cultivation of one's inner spiritual nature or soul. The emphasis on the spiritual capacity of the soul and the importance of cultivating the seed of divinity within each individual had tremendous appeal to the transcendentalists. Virtually all of them were engaged in one way or another with the pursuit of self-culture, and it accounted for everything from methods of spiritual discipline and experiments with alternate lifestyles to efforts at social and religious reform. As Margaret Fuller noted in her memoir, "Very early on, I knew that the only object in life was to grow. I was often false to this knowledge in idolatries of particular objects or impatient longings for happiness, but I have never lost sight of it and have always been controlled by it. And this first gift of love has never been superseded by a later one." Broadly speaking, it was the goal of self-culture to develop a sense of spirituality in everyday life. In pursuing this goal, transcendentalists engaged in a variety of spiritual practices and techniques. First and foremost, they looked to nature as a source of revelations concerning the spiritual life. Thoreau, who speaks most often of nature, remarked in his journal, "My profession is always to be on the alert to find God in nature, to know his lurking places to attend all the oratorios, the operas in nature, to watch for, describe all the divine features which I detect in nature. These spiritual practices included, besides walks in nature, periods of solitude, contemplation, reading, journal keeping, conversation, religious cosmopolitanism, simple living, and action from principle. By such means, the transcendentalists earnestly sought to address some of the same issues we are dealing with today. Like us, they were trying to integrate their ideals with everyday living. Like us, they questioned the prevailing values of society. Like us, they struggled to achieve a loftier perspective from which to resolve the problems of life and confront injustice. The extent to which they were successful in these efforts is largely due to the diligence by which they pursued self-culture. Their lives were certainly no easier than ours. If anything, they were more difficult. The pressures to find a career and get a living were just as great. It was a struggle even to afford an education, to marry and raise a family. Opportunities, especially for women, were limited. And the mid-19th century experienced the longest work week of any period for which we have records. Nevertheless, the transcendentalists and their followers placed a high priority on the cultivation of the soul. They discovered that the combination of what Emerson referred to as plain living and high thinking offered the conditions most favorable to the active pursuit of leisure. Leisure not as free time, but for the purpose of self-culture. In some ways, perhaps it was easier for them. Although they were progressive and forward-looking, they valued the writings of Stoic philosophers and the wisdom of Eastern spiritual traditions. From these and other sources, they learned the importance of spiritual growth and self-discovery, and the value of trying to achieve a sense of wholeness and harmony in life. I think we can learn from the transcendentalists even as they benefited from previous models. Often when I talk about transcendentalist spirituality, people tell me that they find the message an attractive but impractical one. There's a certain wistfulness in the response, as if to say, I wish I could, but I can't, or I'm too busy. I reply that leisure, that is to say, the care of the soul, is not easy. As Thoreau remarked in Walden, moral reform, by which he meant spiritual awareness as well as social justice, is the effort to throw off sleep. Our own condition is more a state of drowsiness than anything else. It's as though we were living in a fog a great deal of the time. If we were able to rouse ourselves from the spiritual stupor we find ourselves so habitually in, perhaps it would be more clear to us the direction in which our life lies. How to wake up, to achieve spiritual awareness, and as a result, to enable the moments of insight to characterize the days of our lives. This is the goal the transcendentalists pursued through a variety of spiritual practices. Maybe these will have some appeal and use for us as well. I think we will find that they are especially congenial to the Unitarian Universalist religious sensibility. They are, after all, a product of our own history and religious temperaments. Following the Civil War, moderate Unitarians sought to impose a creedal statement as a means of congregational cohesion and religious identity. In reaction, many of the transcendentalist ministers joined in forming the Free Religious Association in 1867. The two groups were reconciled when in 1894, the moderates finally dispensed with creedalism altogether. By this time, the major figures of the transcendentalist movement had died, although their influence lived on in Unitarian theology and ways of worship. Transcendentalism continues to be an important strand in our history and religious identity. Enshrined in a significant way in our UU principles and the list of sources from which we derive our faith, the first of which is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. In my view, transcendentalism is not a fly in amber, a relic of the past, but is more akin to the bug in the table Thoreau describes in the closing pages of Walden, hatching from an egg deposited in the living tree many years previously. Who knows, Thoreau writes, what beautiful and winged life, whose egg has been buried for ages under many concentric layers of woodenness in the dead dry life of society, deposited at first in the alburnum of the green and living tree, may unexpectedly come forth amidst society's most trivial and handsome furniture to enjoy its perfect summer at last. Transcendentalism hasn't been buried quite so deep in the American psyche as the bug in Thoreau's table. People have been aware of the transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau in particular, for a very long time. Their works are still widely read and taught in our high schools and colleges. But it's my impression that people don't take them to heart as much as they might. When Thoreau celebrates the possibility of personal transformation, as he does in the passage I just cited, he's not just being rhetorical or poetic. He actually means what he says, namely, that awakening to a more spiritual life is possible for us, for you and me, even in the most unexpected ways and mundane of circumstances. Thank you.